This is the third day of this November 2016 seven-day session. We'll return to our text the previous 2 days, the Zen teaching of Wei Hai on sudden illumination, translated by John Blofeld. John Blofeld visited us at the Zen Center in the, I think it was the late 70s, and maybe mid-70s, stayed with us for 3 days. It was very, very impressive scholar, author, magnificent writing. It's a whole bunch of books that are very inspiring, man of real humility, but great intelligence and grace. I always have fond thoughts of him. He stayed in my room at the Zen Center when he was there. Whenever I read this, I have fond thoughts of him. So this is a question and answer format again. The Venerable Yun Kuang once asked, "Master, do you know where you will be reborn?" And the Master, "We have not died yet, so what is the use of discussing our rebirths? That which knows birth is the unborn. We cannot stray from birth to speak of the unborn. The patriarch once said, that which undergoes birth is really unborn." I have my own note here. I dug this up somewhere. The patriarch refers to Gayashata when he was transmitting the Dharma to Kumarata. These are two of the names in our full ancestral line. "We have not died yet, so what is the use of discussing our rebirths?" This is one of the distinctions between Zen Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism. I can't say for sure about every teaching in Tibetan Buddhism and every teacher, but just my impression from over the years is that they consider rebirth an important part of the belief system for practice. In fact, there was once a debate in the pages of Tricycle Magazine or one of these National Buddhist magazines between Bob Thurman and Stephen Batchelor. Bob Thurman was very close to the Dalai Lama for many, many years. He was the first Westerner to be ordained by the Dalai Lama, and not long after he disrobed. But Bob Thurman, he was a Buddhist scholar himself, was insisting that if you don't believe in rebirth, then you can't come to enlightenment. And Stephen Batchelor was disputing that, as I would. Enlightenment is nothing about what you believe. It's getting rid of your belief systems, emptying the mind, clearing the mind, dislodging from the mind our beliefs. And Zen, I think more, it's fair to say, more than Tibetan Buddhism, points us to this moment, right here. How we're using the mind right now, where our attention is, which means where we are. Someone, there's a dialogue of someone who approached the Buddha in India, and asked a similar question about rebirth. And he said, if you want to know what you were in the past, look at yourself now. If you want to know what you'll be in the future, look at yourself now. Don't waste time speculating, thinking about past lives or future lives. That time could be devoted to working to be fully present. That's what counts. There's a story about Thoreau, I think, who was quite Buddhistic in his own way, but Thoreau was on his deathbed and the minister in attendance asked him, can you see the other side? And he said, one world at a time. I love how people who get these readings of their past lives, they're almost invariably a queen or a king or some monarch or some famous person. My mother used to say, never a chambermaid, just... And then these words of Gayashata, the patriarch, that which undergoes birth is really unborn. The very idea of birth and death arises from emptiness. All things arise from no thingness. Someone said, eternity is in love with the productions of time. I might say, heads are in love with tails. Head of the coin is in love with the tail of the coin. You can't get any more intimate than non-dual. Question, does this apply even to those who have yet to perceive their own nature? Master, your not having perceived your own nature does not imply that you lack that nature. Why so? Because perception itself is that nature. Without it, we should never be able to perceive anything. Consciousness is also that nature. So it is called the nature of consciousness. Understanding is also that nature. Whence it is called the nature of understanding. That which can produce the myriad phenomena of the universe is called the Dharma nature, otherwise known as the Dharmakaya. The patriarch Ashvaghosha declared, in speaking of phenomena, we really refer to the minds of sentient beings. For when mental processes occur, all sorts of phenomena take birth in accordance with them. And when mental processes do not occur, phenomena have nothing in which to arise. There are not even names for them. Again, that koan, number 61 in the Blue Cliff Record, with the arising of a single thought, the nation comes into being. When no thought arises, the nation perishes. Or, from our affirming faith in mind, things are things because of mind. His mind is mind because of things. These two are merely relative. Both its source are emptiness. There can be no universe apart from mind. Just think about it. How could there possibly be the concept of universe apart from the mind that conceives it? Once our master took his place in the assembly hall and said, "It is far better for all of you to be unconcerned men." Unconcerned means not attached to externals. Self-autonomous. Not dependent on things. It's far better for all of you to be unconcerned men. Why all this craze for karmic activities that will put felons' kangs about your necks and send you down to hell? Toiling and moiling the whole day through, telling people you are practicing Chan and studying the way, holding forth about your understanding of the Buddha Dharma, this sort of thing is no use at all. It simply amounts to rushing about in pursuit of sounds and forms. Ah, when will you desist from it all? Once this poor monk, referring to himself, heard the great Ma Zhu say, "Your own treasure house contains absolutely everything you need. Use it freely instead of searching vainly for something outside yourself." If those words sound familiar to you, it's because those were the words that triggered Wei Hai's awakening. We read from that account on the first day of Sesshin. You can be sure he remembered those words. He continues, "From that day forward, I desisted. Making use of your own treasure house according to your needs, that can be called happiness." Let's just go back to a couple of things here. This craze for karmic activities that will put felons' kangs about your necks and send you down to hell. The word kang is one that I had never heard until I began working on koans. It's in at least one of the koans. I looked it up. The kang is like the stocks in the Middle Ages in Europe and the United States. Criminals would sometimes be placed locked in the stocks in the center of the village, with their hands in these rings, sometimes their head too sticking out. That's what we call stocks. A kang is that, but mobile, which they used in China for felons. When you committed certain felonies, you could walk around, but with this apparatus on you, this heavy wood timber with your hands and your head in it, that's a kang. It's a very rich image, isn't it, of the kinds of burden that we take on when we allow ourselves to transgress against our true nature, against others. And then this, where he said, he quotes the words of Ma Zhu that brought him to awakening, and he said, "From that day forward, I desisted." This is what distinguishes a great master like Wei Hai, that he got it right away. All right. I'm not going to be dwelling in things that don't matter, comparing myself to other people. And then he continues, there is no single thing which can be grasped or rejected. When you cease looking on things in their temporal aspect and as having come or gone, then in the whole universe, above, below, and round about, there will be no grain of anything which is not your own nature, your own treasure. All you have to do is carefully to contemplate your own minds. Then the marvelous trinity of the three jewels in one substance will constantly manifest itself. Of this there is no shadow of doubt. Don't look outside yourself. When you step in the Zendo, do you need to look around, check out, see who's sitting, how they're sitting? No. That's not your business. Business is the practice you're working on. You need to, in the dining room, check out how much other people are eating, how they're eating. No. He goes on, do not search for the truth with your intellects. I think a lot of people do this without even realizing it. They sit, and instead of just losing themselves in the breath or the koan they're working on, they're thinking. They're searching, maybe, trying to figure out this matter. It won't work. Mu has never been figured out by anyone. You don't have to figure it out. Just become it. The nature of the mind is intrinsically pure. Therefore, it is written in the Avatamsaka Sutra, all things have no beginning, and all things have no end. Another dialogue, the Venerable Dao Quang, who is an adherent of the Dharmalaksana school, which holds that consciousness is real, and also a commentator upon the sutras, inquired, Master, what mental processes do you employ in pursuing the way? Master, I have no mental processes that would be of use, and no way to follow. Mental processes would be thinking. None of that would be of any use. And no way to follow. Then this question. If both those statements are true, why is it that every day you convene gatherings during which you urge others to learn how to follow the way by means of chan? Master, this old monk does not possess even a dot of ground in which to stick an awl, so how can he gather people? He does not have so much as a tongue, then how can he urge people to do anything? This odd way of speaking, of course, is referring to the emptiness of everything. But the questioner says, "Why, Master, you are lying to my face." "Master, how can this old monk, being without a tongue to urge people, tell a lie?" Answer: "Really, I do not understand the way the Venerable Chan Master talks." And then he closes the deal by saying, "Nor does this old monk understand himself." He knows that there is no self to understand. You have to give this master of a different training, different school of Buddhism, cut him some slack here. And Chan has its own style and its own way of negating whatever is being asserted by the other side. And going to the essential point of things, which can sound utterly unconventional. There's a story I know some of you have heard where a very highly esteemed Tibetan Buddhist Rinpoche, Kalu Rinpoche, long since has died, but this is back in the 70s, I think, where Kalu Rinpoche had a meeting with a Korean Zen teacher, Sungsan Sunim, and the two of them were doing their best to discuss the Dharma, and the Korean Zen teacher turned to an orange that was sitting there on the table, and he said, "What is this?" And Kalu Rinpoche turned to his attendant and said, "Do they not have oranges where he was born? Don't they not have oranges in Korea?" It's different language. This is a short one, short to the point. Someone asked, "Is prajna very large?" "It is." "How large?" "Unlimited." "Is prajna small?" "It is." "How small?" "So small as to be invisible." "Where is it?" "Where is it not?" Prajna means wisdom. A monk asked, "Since all the myriad phenomena are non-existent, the nature of mind should also be non-existent. Just as a bubble, having burst, can never reform, so can a man once dead never be reborn, for nothing remains of him. Where will the nature of his mind be then?" Master: "Bubbles are composed of water. When a bubble bursts, does the water composing it cease to be?" "Our bodies proceed from our real nature. When we die, why should you say that our nature is no more?" And then the monk: "If you maintain there is such a nature, bring it forth and show it to me." Master: "Do you believe there will be a tomorrow? "Yes, certainly. Bring it forth and show it to me." Well, there will surely be a morrow, but not just now. And then Wei Hai, yes, but it's not being just now does not mean that there will be no morrow. You personally do not perceive your own nature, but this does not mean that your nature does not exist. Just now, there is before you that which wears a robe, takes food, and walks, stands, sits, or reclines, but you do not recognize it for what it is. You may well be called a stupid and deluded person. If you discriminate between today and tomorrow, that is like using your own nature to search for your own nature. You will not perceive it even after myriads of eons. Yours is a case of not seeing the sun, not of there being no sun. A Dharma master inquired, "Do you believe that the greatest merit derives from the recitation of the Prajna Sutra, the Heart Sutra, the Prajna Paramita?" This must have been a widely held view. Understandably, the Prajna Paramita is arguably the core sutra in all of Buddhism. It's the one, I think, it's the one that is most widely chanted in Buddhist countries throughout the world, as it is here. Do you believe that the greatest merit derives from the recitation of the Prajna Sutra? I do not. So all 10 volumes of the Stories of Divine Responses, that's a title I've never heard of, are unworthy of belief? And then Wei Hai, filial piety practiced while parents are still alive ensures divine responses and rewards. This does not mean you have to wait until after their death so that their bleached skeletons may bless you. Sutras are made of paper covered with words printed in ink. But printed words, paper, and ink are without self-nature. So from whence will those divine responses capable of fulfilling your wishes come? Effectual answers come from proper use of the mind, by the person who reads the sutras. And this explains how the divine power works in response to appeal from a living being. You may test this for yourself by taking a volume of the sutras and leaving it quietly on a table. If nobody picks it up and recites it and practices it, do you suppose it can possibly have any marvelous efficacy in itself? This is an example of the rejection in Zen, the Zen school of magic. It's another difference between Tibetan Buddhism and Zen Buddhism. Or other schools of Buddhism might also say give magical properties to a sutra or to an object of devotion. A vajra device. But Wei Hai won't have it. It's when we are using it, putting our mind behind it, that it acquires significance. It's the same with a koan. There's nothing magical about the word mu. It's how we engage with it that reveals it as our true nature, our own true nature. The same with everything else. A dish, a cup, it's how we engage with it that will make all the difference. Same with, come to think of it, with Dharani. Dharani, the long one, is the Daishin Dharani. And then there's the Shosaimyo Kijicho Dharani. Dharani are just a sequence of mantras. And by themselves, they're syllables that, especially if they're not in English, have nothing to them. But it's by how we engage with them, how we do the chanting of the Dharani and the other chants, not just Dharani. It's the degree to which we are fully absorbed in them and one with them that brings out their power. Here's one sobering dialogue. Someone once asked, if we follow the way with undivided mind, will the load of karmic obstructions resulting from our past deeds be dissipated? Master, for those who have not yet perceived their own nature, it will not be dissipated. Whereas those who perceive it thereby wipe out all karmic obstruction, just as the hot sun melts the frost and snow. They may be likened to people able to burn up all the grass covering the mighty slopes of Mount Sumeru in a single flash, for their karmic obstruction is like that grass, and their wisdom is like that fire. Mount Sumeru is this mythological mountain in the center of the universe. A lot of Buddhists for centuries have taken it literally. They believe there's a mountain in the center of the universe. The Dalai Lama, to his credit, scoffs at that. He says if something does not agree with science, then got to get rid of it. But consider this. Those who perceive it, as those who perceive their own nature, and for them, it'll wipe out all karmic obstruction, just as the hot sun melts the frost and snow. I think of the words in the Hakuin chant, one true samadhi extinguishes evil. It purifies karma, removing obstruction, something like that. A monk inquired the meaning of prajna. If you suppose that this is the Weihai's response, if you suppose that anything is not prajna, let me hear what it is. Just pause there. This too contradicts our rational mind, where we think of there are the blind passions, and then there is our wisdom. There's bodhi, wisdom, and there is delusion. But awakening reveals that there is only this bodhi mind. There is only prajna. Well, what do you mean? How can that be? There is only this true nature. If you suppose that anything is not prajna, let me hear what it is. Question, how may we perceive our own nature? Master, that which perceives is your own nature. Without it, there could be no perception. Question, then what is self-cultivation? Meaning practice. Master, refraining from defiling your own nature and from deceiving yourself is the practice of self-cultivation. When your own nature's mighty function manifests itself, this is the unequaled Dharmakaya. Refraining from defiling your own nature and from deceiving yourself. It's a description of true Zazen. Zazen beyond thought. That's true Zazen. It's refraining from defiling our own, the purity of our own true nature. It's refraining from deceiving ourself. Zazen Samadhi. Question, does our own nature include evil? Master, it does not even include good. Question, if it contains neither good nor evil, where should we direct it when using it? Master, to set your mind on using it is a great error. Then what should we do to be right? Master, there's nothing to do and nothing which can be called right. People can sometimes become confounded by this kind of these kinds of dialogues. What he's doing is trying to pull the rug out from this monk's delusive thinking, his set ideas about the way things are. But he's not, it's not, what he's saying is not made up. It's not erroneous. He's speaking the truth. There is nothing to do and nothing which can be called right. From the very beginning, there has never been a single thing. Here's a practical question and a practical reply. Once somebody inquired, suppose someone is sitting in a boat and the boat keel cuts to death a shellfish. Is the man guilty or should the boat be blamed? And then Wei Hai, man and boat had no mind to kill the shellfish and the only person to be blamed is you. When a tearing wind snaps off a branch which falls and kills somebody, there is no murderer and no murdered. In all the world, there is no place where living beings do not have to suffer. Man and boat had no mind to kill the shellfish. This is a key point in Buddhist doctrine and regarding karma, causation, is it's all about intention. Which doesn't mean there's no responsibility to anyone. The shellfish, by being there in that place in the water, also has some responsibility for it. Not blame, but responsibility. Yasutani Roshi makes this point in the Three Pillars of Zen, that in a train crash, even the victims, the casualties in the train crash, had some responsibility. Just by virtue of having been there. Again, not blame, but some responsibility. That's what I meant in this letter I sent to the Sangha right the day before Sesshin, that we are all responsible in some way for what happened last week in the election. Even if we worked tirelessly to effect a certain result of the election, in the end, when it's over with, we all have some responsibility, just like those passengers on the train. It is our karma to face now. Question, what is illusion? Master, illusion has no stable appearance. It is like a whirling fire, like a mirage city, like puppets on strings, like the mirage oases caused by sunbeams, like flowers in the sky. None are real. These are nice analogies for what we call illusion. A whirling fire, this is the image that's created. If you are holding a torch and circling it fast, it creates this like a circle of fire. Same with a flashlight, you get the same effect of a flashlight. Like a mirage city, like puppets on strings, like the mirages we can see in from movies at least, and from the desert, people crawling across the desert and they see what appears to be an oasis. It's just an illusion, makyo. Like flowers in the sky. This refers to floaters, what we today would call floaters, an optical illusion, seeing particles where there are none. But the point is that we never want to make a thing out of this ego illusion of self and other. Because there's nothing there. There's no deluded one. Question, who is the great illusionist? Answer, mind is the great illusionist. The mind is the city of great illusion, and names are its garments and sustenance. In all the worlds, countless as Ganges sands, there is not anything which is outside illusion. Worldlings, unable to understand illusion, are deluded by illusory karma wherever they happen to be. The Buddha is the great illusionist who turned the great illusory Dharma wheel, attained illusory nirvana, transmuted illusory samsara into that which is beyond birth and death, and transformed lands of filth, innumerable as the sands of the Ganges, into the pure Dharma Dhatu. This statement, there is not anything which is outside illusion, speaks to the world of appearances, that phenomena, all phenomena, the world of phenomena, is illusory in that it is empty. There's no substance to it. We are deceived by phenomena. They appear to have substance, substantiality. But we know from modern scientific instruments that they're just energy. Physical objects, and especially mental objects, thoughts, it's all just energy in a certain transitory form. Everything is in flux. Everything is illusory. Time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.